You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Malcolm Gladwell is the author of the best-selling books The Tipping Point and Blink, both of which introduce complex social and scientific concepts to the general public. Now, in his latest work, he investigates the idea of success, and he's called the book Outliers. I'm pleased that it brings New Yorker staff writer Malcolm Gladwell back to this show. Welcome. It's always a pleasure to see you.
Yeah, glad to be back.
Was it your goal here to refute the idea that success is primarily a product of our merits and intelligence? What did you feel you had to challenge that?
Well, you know, it was. There's a series of incredibly persistent myths about success in this country. That we think we refute, but we don't. We still come back to them again and again. The sort of self-made man notion, the rags to riches idea, the idea that we are this kind of wide open, fair meritocracy, and none of those
that,
are true.
That the poor are poor because they just don't have what it takes to be successful,
and that if they had what it took, they would no longer be poor. Yes, I mean these are all ideas that kind of float around there and actually have an impact on. The policies that we make and institutions we build, and I wanted to kind of move us away from that simplistic reading of success.
And you told Newsweek that to some degree it was a reaction to the mood of self-congratulation you saw in business executives.
Yeah, you know, when you look at the lives, I mean, part of this book is devoted to sort of examining the lives of very, very successful people, Bill Gates and the top lawyers in New York and the Beatles, et cetera. And when you look at the lives of people like that, what you're struck by is just how much circumstance and luck and extraordinary opportunities played in their success, and how little. It's not that the individual is unimportant, but the individual plays a much smaller role than we would imagine.
Well, you saw those. Business executives before the recent economic meltdown. What do you think the CEOs who felt that they were underpaid at $50 million a year are saying nowadays?
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, we really ought to hold them to their particular myth if, in fact, they're the ones who are responsible for the success a couple years ago. They should be the ones held responsible for the failure now.
So is this a political book, do you think, more political than your other books?
More political than my other books. I mean, it's more sort of engaged with broader social issues. The other ones were interested in sort of small slices of everyday life, and this one is broader in its perspective.
How would you define an outlier?
Well, that term is comes from science, and it's to describe phenomena that lie outside of ordinary experience. And so, I was interested in. You know, the thing about people who lie outside of ordinary experience, the special cases, is that they kind of crystallize. They allow us to sort of they're much easier sources of insight about the phenomenon we're studying. If you want to really know about what it means to be good at golf, you really should start with Tiger Woods. I mean, if you want to know about what it takes to get rich, you should start with Bill Gates. And if you want to know about music, you should start with the Beatles. You know, so that was the kind of idea behind the book, that we'll start with the extreme cases and we'll see what we can learn about the rest of us.
But geniuses are extreme cases. Mm-hmm. And you even talk about one guy who had an IQ score of 195. Mm-hmm. But many geniuses aren't successful.
Yeah, you know, I wanted at the beginning of the book, I try to sort of set the stage for what I really want to talk about by clearing aside some troublesome and persistent myths. And one of the things I wanted to attack was this kind of love affair we have with intelligence. And so I tell the story of this guy, Chris Langan, who has the highest recorded IQ in America, 195. To put that in perspective, Einstein's was 160. He's got 35 points on Einstein. In whose life has not been, he has not made the kind of mark on the American intellectual scene that his gifts would suggest he would, right? He lives in a small house on a farm in northwestern Missouri and has written lots of things that never published anything, really. So the question was, why is that, right? And shouldn't people who have those kinds of extraordinary gifts, shouldn't they sort of succeed effortlessly if we are, in fact, a meritocracy that rewards? But in fact, they don't. And I tell the story of a very famous study done in the 20s by Lewis Terman, who identifies thousands of children in California with genius-level IQs and follows them for 50 years And his belief was this would prove once and for all that in America, intelligence gets you as far as you need to go. And what he discovered was the opposite, that the children from wealthy families did well and those from poor families didn't.
Despite the similarity of their IQs.
Despite the fact
so should we group kids by IQ? That has been the general system over the years.
Yeah, I don't. I have become, since writing this book, a big foe of any kind of streaming in schools. I realize that's a very unpopular position. But because when you look at these much broader perspectives on the lives of the intelligent, you realize that so much else plays a role in eventual real-life success that it's, you know, why are we picking on IQ as a way to stream kids when they're 8 years old? Why don't we pick on persistence or resilience or, you know, those things are every bit, if not more important in terms of how well you succeed as an adult.
So have you ever been to a Mensa meeting?
I've never been. I don't think I could make the cut at Mensa, so.
You also looked into why so many professional hockey players turn out to have been born early in the year. I'm assuming you're talking only about Canadian players.
No, anywhere in the world.
Really? So
that people play hockey.
So Russian, Czech, U.S. Hockey players?
Everyone does. Because the rules of international hockey are that the cutoff date for eligibility for age class hockey programs is January 1st, right? So in countries like Canada or Czechoslovakia, where they start selecting all-star teams at the age of 8 or 9 years old, right? They go into these peewee hockey clubs and they find the best players because they want to pull them out and give them special access to coach. They want to find the all-stars, right? Well, who's the all-star at age 8? It's the kid who is the oldest, right? Because at the age of 8, someone born in January has got 8 months or 9 months of maturity on someone born in November or December. And at that age, 8 months is huge.
So would Wayne Gretzky have been less likely to have been as talented as he was if he hadn't been born on January 26th?
He certainly had. Well, Gretzky may be such an extreme case. I'd hate to say.
But he was born in January, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, he does. So, you know, those January kids get, they get pulled out at the age of 8. They get special coaching, extra practice, more games, more encouragement. You know, so by the time they're 17, 18, they really are better. Whether that explains enough is enough to explain Gretzky. You know, understand I'm a Canadian. If I were to say anything untoward about Gretzky, people would come after me with knives, so I have to be careful.
My guest is Malcolm Gladwell, whose latest book is Outliers, The Story of Success. It's published by Little Brown. You mentioned the Beatles, and they're included in your 10,000-hour rule section.
Mm-hmm.
Where did that number come from?
So a number of expertise researchers, as they're known in psychology, have done some really fabulous work looking at this question of how long does it take to be good at something complicated, right? So we look at any field you want. You name a complex field, we'll look at it. And they look at it and they say, okay, at what point do the people in that field achieve expertise? So if we look at classical music composers, how long does it take how much preparation do you need to write a work of truly brilliant classical music? And the answer is, you need to have about 10,000 hours of practice before you can do that. Same with chess, same with hitting a fastball or a curveball, same with being a medical specialist, same with in an incredible number of fields, it all comes down to 10,000 hours, which is roughly 10 years.
Except if you're a hockey player, and in that case, you should have been born in January.
Yes, there are other factors that go into it. But
10,000 hours, I don't know how many hours that is, but that's a long time.
It's 10 years. It's roughly 10 years. It's 4 hours a day, and that comes out to 10 years.
Well, that would mean nobody would do anything before they were 30 years old.
Well, but remember, a lot of people start. So, you know, Mozart starts composing at 10, and by the age of 22 or so, he does Concerto No. 9, 271, his first great masterwork. Bobby Fischer starts playing chess at around 9 or 10, and by the age of 20, he's a grandmaster. So, it's possible to do things young, but you have to start young. But so the Beatles are a beautiful example of this because they get their 10,000 hours in before the other bands of their era, because they go off to Hamburg when they're teenagers, and they play as a house band in a strip club they play 7 and 8 hour sets 7 days a week for months at a stretch and get an incredible, it's like they're this intensive medical residency in rock and roll. And by the time they emerge from that residency, they're good.
But I used to live next door to a garage band that must have played at least 10,000 hours. At least it felt that long.
I think it felt that way, yes.
Still, there must be others who weren't as successful as the Beatles. And it's my sense the Beatles brilliantly plugged into the zeitgeist and also had a really great promoter.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'm not talking about – it's not enough to do 10,000 hours. You need to have other factors play into this. And you must start with some level of ability. You must be musical in some sense, or at least have the ability to kind of extract from that 10,000 hours something of value. You could give me a guitar and have me play for 10,000 hours, and I'm not going to be John Lennon, right? I'm not saying that talent doesn't matter, but I'm saying that the role that effort and preparation play is much larger than we would imagine, and that until someone has put in that requisite amount of effort, no amount of talent in the world will make them good.
And that's why musicians are told to practice.
Yeah, yeah.
You discuss the stories of computer programmer billionaires, Bill Gates and Steve Jobs, who were both born in 1959. And
55,
I'm sorry. And Bill Joy of Sun Microsystems, he was born in 1954, pretty much the same time. Why is the period in which they were born so important to take note of?
So, yeah, I play this game a lot in the book of looking at birth dates and wondering about advantages that accrue to specific generations. So in that part, if you look at, and it's not just those, so Gates, Joy, and Jobs are probably the three most important people in the history of the personal computer. Joy is the guy who writes all the software for the PC. But you can add, it's not just those three. An extraordinary number of very powerful people in Silicon Valley were born in the same year, 1955, and that's not a coincidence. It's because the PC revolution is really starts in 1976. It was then that people first got this idea that you could build a personal computer that was affordable and would bring computing to the public. And the question is, what's the perfect age to be when the revolution starts? And the answer is you want to be 21, right? You want to be out of college. You want to have no commitments. You don't want to be married. You don't want to have a mortgage. And you don't want to be so old that you've already been inducted into the old paradigm.
You didn't get a job at IBM already.
If you're 24 and you're a computer programming whiz in 1976, you're working for IBM and you're working on mainframes, right? You've been taken up in the old idea. So you don't want to be that old. And you want to be old enough that you're free to pursue the revolution. So you can't be 16, right, in 1976. You want to be 21. And that's a really kind of simple thing that we overlook when we talk about the genius of these programmers. We forget they're also lucky in the sense of when they first encountered this revolution.
I wonder if the same thing could be applied to Nobel Prize winners or any number of other places where people have succeeded.
Yeah. Well, there's all kinds of fun games you can play with Nobel Prize winners. You know this thing about how the single thing that all Nobel Prize winners have in common is that they were overwhelmingly taught by other Nobel Prize winners. Do you know this? It's really amazing. An incredible number is something like, it's more than half of Nobel Prize winners at some point were taught by another Nobel Prize winner. Now,
so they had role models.
They had role models. But also, at the time they were taught by the Nobel Prize winner, the Nobel Prize winner hadn't won his Nobel Prize. So, in other words, Nobel Prize winners are people who have the ability to find the best person in their field and are savvy enough to go and seek them out and teach with them. So, you know, you don't win Nobel Prize just because you're, you know, scientifically brilliant. You also have to have some degree of savvy. And I talk a lot about that in the book, about how the savvy part is really this kind of ability to kind of get your way and understand the rules of the game is a critical part.
I'm talking with Malcolm Gladwell, who was a business and science reporter at the Washington Post before he became a staff writer at the New Yorker and began writing bestsellers, number one international bestsellers like The Tipping Point and Blink. His latest is Outliers, the story of success, published by Little Brown. We will continue our conversation after this. Later in the show, we'll hear the latest on the ongoing debate over who owns the past from the Elgin marbles of ancient Greece that are in the collection of the British Museum in London to Egyptian treasures in museums all over the world. Also, Mike Daisy's latest performance piece about the military-industrial complex. And then Patricia T. O'Connor takes your calls on the crazy English language that we speak. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're back with Malcolm Gladwell, whose latest book is Outliers, The Story of Success. It is published by Little Brown. You cite the KIPP school program in the Bronx. Mm-hmm. How does that program alter the opportunities of lower-income school children?
Well, that comes at a time in the book when one of the big themes of this book is work, right? It's understanding the role of work and our attitudes towards work. And there's some really brilliant research done by a guy named Carl Alexander, who's a sociologist, and he has shown, and a number of others have shown the same thing, that when you look at the gap in learning between poor kids and rich kids, it doesn't open up during the school year. It opens up during the summer holidays, right? So during the school year, poor kids learn every bit as much as rich kids. But during the summer, the rich kids keep learning and the poor kids don't. Why? Because they go home to environments that don't offer the same kind of richness and resources.
And the rich kids often wind up in Europe visiting museums
and going to camps and getting all kinds of instruction. And so this has led to this. I mean, the KIPP Academy is in part, which is a kind of a movement, a charter school movement that's springing up around the country. Is based in part on that fact. So they say, all right, so what poor kids need is more school, right? The problem isn't that they aren't learning in school, that schools work brilliantly for them. They just don't have enough of it. And so these kids go to school and they start their day at 7:30. They end their day at 5. They go to school on Saturday. They have a 3 weeks of school in the summer. I mean, it's a much more intensive environment, and it has proven to be extraordinarily successful.
And it gets you around the problem of parental involvement and home life as issues in motivating kids to do well.
Yeah, and it gets us away from
So you're going to eliminate summer vacation? Oh, kids are going to love you.
Well, you know, you know why? I go into summer vacation at length in the book. We have summer vacation because there was a crackpot theory in the 19th century advanced by, among others, Horace Mann, which said that one of the leading causes of madness and depression among children was overstimulation, too much school. And so in reaction to this, there was this big reform movement in the 19th century which said, let's give them 3 months off so they don't go crazy. Well, this is, of course, nonsense.
Well, your success, did you work summer vacations? You were a poor kid.
Not a poor kid. No. I was a good, solid middle class kid.
I was a poor kid.
You were?
Yeah.
But I didn't grow up in the hothouse of, I mean, this difference between the socialization patterns of wealthier families and lower income families has emerged in very strongly in the last 25, 30 years, and has emerged in places like New York most strongly. You know, in little small town Canada where I was growing up, it wasn't as much of an issue. Although it was, you know, there was a difference.
I was really encouraged to succeed, and I was put in classes with kids who were smart, and we were pushed despite the fact that we were poor, and in schools that probably score as poorly. My high school has been closed down. It was so bad, Eastern District High School.
Mm-hmm. But whereabouts is that high school?
In Williamsburg, Brooklyn.
Oh, okay.
Not in the hip part of Williamsburg.
Yeah.
But maybe that's changed. Or maybe the attitudes of kids who are disadvantaged has changed.
Well, it's funny because I have one of the chapters of this book is all about lawyers in New York. The generation of the sons of Jewish immigrants from Eastern Europe who went on to great success in the legal profession in the 60s and 70s and 80s.
Joe Flom, the guy
from Wachtell Lipton, and they all have exactly the same background as you. They come from the Bronx and Brooklyn. They went to public schools. I don't know where you went to college. They're city college overwhelmingly.
Public colleges. Yeah. I went to Brooklyn and Hunter.
Yeah. Exactly the same background. And I talk about how that was actually a very magical time in this city, that generation had the benefit of a public school system when the New York public school system was one of the best in the world, which is a function in part of the Depression, remember, because so many incredibly able people couldn't get jobs elsewhere that they went into teaching, and we had this magic period.
Well, we would like to believe that we're a classless society, but the fact is that rich kids do have all sorts of advantages, including the Matthew effect, which you call the Matthew effect, which the whole legacy thing that allowed someone like George W. Bush to go to Yale even if his marks weren't all that good.
Yeah. My favorite little moment in the book, one of my favorite moments is Jeb Bush, George's brother, you know, the brother of a president, the son of a president, the grandson of a senator and a Wall Street potentate, in his, when he was running for governor of Florida, described himself as a self-made man, which is just, I mean, it's beyond comedy, isn't it? But it's a symptom of just how much people of privilege have convinced themselves that they did it all themselves, which is just, you know, it's nonsensical.
Are you arguing for affirmative action in this book?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I don't explicitly argue it, but look, once you understand just how much embedded advantage there is in the lives of people who come from privilege, then it becomes impossible to deny the extension of some small degree of advantage to people who didn't come from privilege, right? Once we understand all of the ways in which the deck was stacked in favor of the wealthy, who are we to stand up and say we shouldn't make some small measure on behalf of those who didn't come from wealth? I mean, it just strikes me as, it seems almost the debate, the arguments against affirmative action start to sound really churlish when you appreciate just how much of this kind of embedded opportunity there is in certain people's lives.
Because you say that things can be turned around. A bad thing can be turned around into a positive thing. One of the examples you give is Korean Air's turnaround after having had one of the worst flying records during the 1990s. Mm-hmm. And that came out of Korean cultural legacy.
Yeah, so I get really interested in the second half of the book in the role that cultures play in how well we do our jobs. And I get really interested in the role that culture plays, for example, in mathematics achievement and also in flying, because it turns out that the most important variable in explaining the safety record of an airline is the culture that the pilots come from. And there are certain cultures in the world where that are not a good fit for flying an airplane, and certain cultures that are a great fit. And nothing matters more than this. It's not about the plane. It's not about training. It's not about the weather. It is about the culture of the pilots and the assumptions they bring into the cockpit. And in cultures, you know, flying a plane safely requires the co-pilot and the first officer and the captain to communicate openly and freely. And in cultures where it is difficult for a subordinate to speak openly and freely to a superior, you have problems flying planes. So hierarchical cultures typically have the most plane crashes. Korea is a very hierarchical culture. And as a result, they had a crisis at Korean Air in the 80s and 90s where they were almost actually put out of business because they had such a bad safety record. And that chapter is all about how Korean Air solved that problem. How it's really an extraordinary story about how an institution faced its cultural issues and changed them. And today, Korean Air is a world-class airline. And it's a sign of how, if we're honest about our cultural legacies and we face up to them, we can make a tremendous difference in how well we achieve.
My guest is Malcolm Gladwell. His latest book, Outliers, The Story of Success, is published by Little Brown. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, what about the cultural legacy that has led some kids to grow up in an environment where their peers look down on them if they achieve academic success?
Yeah.
How do we get past that?
Yeah. Well, I went to the, when I was doing this book, went to the Kipp Academy in the Bronx, which is a set of schools that is trying to confront that very idea.
Well, but I'm sure that the parents are a reason the kids go to those schools. In some cases, parents aren't clever enough to even know that that's a possibility or don't seem to care, and then the kids wind up in an environment where they may even be interested, but they're looked down on if they succeed.
But I feel like if you go to Kipp, you understand, I think, that there is hope in confronting that that particular cultural idea, and that you can create schools in the midst of disadvantage that have profoundly different attitudes towards academic accomplishment. I mean, it was possible back when you were a kid in Williamsburg at a time if you go back early, if you go back to the Depression in New York, where there was, a time of infinitely greater despair than now, when schools were these oases of learning and achievement and motivation. We did it 70, 80 years ago. There's no reason we can't do it again. And I feel it is being done right now by some of these schools in the Bronx. And by the KIPP and among other charter schools.
You include a bit of your own story at the end of the book about how specifically your mother's success derived from hard work, but also the opportunities that she was given. The hard work would not have been enough, and the opportunities alone would not have been enough?
Yeah, so my mom is Jamaican and grew up in a little tiny cottage in the middle of the hills of Jamaica and, you know, made it out and became as an upper middle class professional in Canada. And I always thought her story was a story about her own ambition and intelligence and pluck. And then I went back and sat down with my mom and my cousins and reported that, you know, for the first time learned the real story of how my mother achieved. And it's a much more complicated and much more fascinating story. And it says that, and with roots that go back hundreds of years. I mean, I traced my family history back to the 1800s, 1700s. And when you put my mother in the full perspective of her culture and her family history, and you talk about what it means to be brown-skinned in Jamaica, and you talk about the history of
mixed race?
Mixed race. My mother is a mixed race product of a very peculiar British colonial legacy in Jamaica, which conferred all kinds of extraordinary advantages on her. And so, you know, when you see that, you understand my mother didn't do it alone. She was the product of this extraordinarily rich mix of opportunities. And that should humble us. It certainly humbles my mother, you know.
One other thing, a listener wonders about how we get past learning disabilities, because there are some people whose brains are just not wired like other people. They're smart, but they're dyslexic, or they have some other thing that just makes it harder for them to learn the way everyone else can learn.
Yeah, yeah. No, though it's funny. I in my last New Yorker piece, I talked about this fascinating finding that, do you know that an extraordinarily high percentage, perhaps as much of a third of American entrepreneurs, suffer from learning disabilities like dyslexia?
And a lot of artists.
And a lot of artists. These are people who have compensated for their disadvantage by learning other skills, which have proved to be very useful. And what's interesting to me is, can we figure out why they were able to compensate so brilliantly? You know, why was Richard Branson or all of these people with dyslexia able to? And if we can understand what helped them compensate, then I think we can provide opportunities for people with those sorts of disabilities.
Malcolm Gladwell's latest book is Outliers, A Story of Success, published by Little Brown. I'm not going to ask you what you're working on now, because it's always fun to find out when the book finally comes out, or to guess as we read your articles in The New Yorker where you're going.
But I'm doing something fun right now for The New Yorker. I will say that. It's about quarterbacks and teachers. It's a fun one.
Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thanks, Leonard.
Up next, the latest in the ongoing debate over who owns the past, from the ancient Greek Elgin marbles in the British Museum in London to Egyptian treasures in the collections of museums all over the world, and whether stolen antiquity should be repatriated. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.